Well, I guess I'm here to speak with you about how easy things are. Really. How falling out of bed easy everything is. We come upon the spiritual solution, the idea of a spiritual solution to the immense problems that these lives present to us, the immense problem of the just unsatisfactory nature of being human, being assailed with all the things we want, all the things we don't want, all the things we get not wanting them, all the things we fail to get wanting them, all the effort we make to be good and true, right and righteous, to no avail. It seems, and certainly for anyone who has stumbled upon the spiritual arena, it seems that life is hard. The first noble truth is that life is hard. Life sucks. Life is suffering. And it takes a really refined sense of the hardness of life to even have any interest in spiritual solutions. If there's no problem, then there's no need for a solution. And generally, when we happen upon the spiritual arena, it's because the agony, the horrendous nature of being human in this world has so overwhelmed us that we'll try anything. Nothing we've done so far has worked. None of our efforts to gain fame or fortune or peace or love or relationship or any of the other things we look for in the world, they haven't helped us any. Maybe we haven't been able to get what we want in the world, or maybe we have been able to get what we want in the world, and it reveals itself to be sand in our fingers, useless, doesn't do it. But in any event, if we find ourselves in a spiritual practice or in a spiritual realm, it pretty much is for certain that we arrived here because we really didn't like the way our life was going, because we really wanted something to be different, and we have somehow discovered that what we want we can't get anywhere but in some spiritual context, some spiritual struggle, because it is a struggle. We know that. All the sutras and Upanishads and Shastras and Gitas and all of that tell us how what a struggle spiritual life is. How careful we have to be. How discerning and discriminating we have to be. How if we set out on a wrong path, we may doom ourselves to a life that is unfulfilled in the end. It doesn't meet its purpose in the end. If we set out on a path and we find ourselves unable to adhere to the requirements of that path, we know that we're in trouble. If we set out on a path and discover that we've been sucked into some trick, well, that's trouble too. We know from our experience in the world, as well as from the teachings that we receive from the spiritual realm, that we have to be very careful about what we do. If we want to be free, then we have to be very careful about what path we choose, what teaching we embrace, what teacher we go to. We have to choose well, choose wisely, and stick to it once we find what seems to suit us, and listen to no temptations to deviate from the path that has chosen us, or that we have chosen. It's hard. The fight, the struggle for enlightenment is hard. It takes time. Some say it takes lifetimes. Some say it takes many lifetimes of strenuous, stringent effort. It's hard. The view that it takes lifetimes is not so popular in this culture, but sure to God it takes a lifetime. It takes doing the right thing. It takes care. It takes hard work. But that's not my experience. I mean, it is certainly my experience that upon happening upon the possibility of a spiritual solution to the foolishness of this life, it is my experience that that's what I heard, that I have to be really careful, that if I choose the wrong path, the wrong way, that I could be condemned, doomed to failing in this life. I certainly is the case that when I stumbled upon the spiritual arena, what I received was that there is a true way of doing things. And if I deviate from that, I won't get what I'm after. And what I'm after is enlightenment or awakening or self-realization, whatever name we call it by. God consciousness, I suppose. Some transformation of this mind into God itself. Some final solution, if you will, to the problem of the ugliness of my personality and my ego, and so forth. I knew that I had to choose well, and that I had to stick to what I chose, and almost put blinders on so that I wouldn't be distracted by things that called to me from over here or called to me from over there, by thoughts even. I mean, thoughts are horrible things. They take me out of myself. They capture me. They trap me in a prison of bondage and misery, smallness and contraction, separation. So I had to be really careful. I had to work really hard for this goal of self-realization. And I watched myself with great care. And I berated myself when my practice wasn't what it seemed it should be. And I tried very hard to prevent myself from being distracted by the blandishments of other teachings or the blandishments of my foolish heart wanting things that were not spiritual, or the power of my thoughts to trap me. My God, my thoughts could trap me. This is all nonsense. Really. It's all abject foolishness, stupidity with which we beat ourselves. If we look carefully, not at the stories about reality that have arisen around all of the great beings that have appeared and told us how simple it is, if we look at what actually has been said to us by those who have announced the great good news that you are free, and not bother so much with all of the songs and sutras and shastras and Upanishads and Gitas and commentaries and metaphysical musings and all of that. I mean, it's okay, that stuff. But if we just for a moment put that stuff aside and look at what actually has been said by those who claim to be free, we see that what they actually say is really quite simple and actually incomprehensible. What they say is, you already are free. You already are realized. You already are Buddha, just as you are. That there's nothing whatsoever you can do to attain freedom or self-realization. Nothing. The quest for freedom and self-realization is a false trail. And the reason it is because you already are that. You have never not been that. Now, what they all also agree on is that the only thing that gives rise to this dream of misery and bondage and suffering is a false idea about what I am. It is the idea that I am the story about me that is constantly unfolding, constantly changing, constantly referring to memory and history and what I was then and what I should be now and what I am not and what I ought to be and what I want to be and what I don't want to be and what this thought means about me and what this emotional experience means about me and what this relationship or lack of relationship means about me. They all tell us that the only thing that gives rise to the belief in the dream of misery and bondage is the idea that I am that story, the belief that I am that story. And God knows that even when we stumble into the spiritual arena, we hold tight to that belief. I mean, it's not so much that we hold tight to it, we don't even know we have it. That's the way it is with a belief. It's not something that you can say, oh, okay, I don't want that anymore. It is the very lens through which we see everything. So even when we happen upon the spiritual path and the announcement, you are free now, here, in this moment, we say, yes, but what about these bad thoughts that keep coming? What about these negative emotions that keep coming? What about pain? What about deprivation? What about hunger and cold? What about loneliness? All of which, of course, are stories about me. Part of the endlessly unfolding story that seeks to define me, seeks to present a picture of me that I can relate to and understand and do something about. So we enter the spiritual arena and we go on about our regular business of trying to do something about this story of me, this history, this conglomeration of thought and sensational experience, trying to understand it, trying to fix it, trying to ignore it, trying to get rid of it, trying to do something, anything. But here, the simplicity of what's being offered in all of the great spiritual teachings, which is that there's nothing to do. Nothing. Already, in this moment, just as you are eternal freedom itself. Permanent. Untouched. Untouchable. Reality itself. And that this is true no matter what the state of your story might be. That this is true not at some future point when you have overcome the negative thoughts and the negative emotions, when you have made to disappear the idea of me as a separate being. Not at some time in the future when the story has taken a different tone to it, but now. Right now, here in this moment, in the midst of all the craziness, in the midst of the powerful feeling of being separate and alone and worthless. You are free. You are reality itself. And that the whole of the story, the totality of the story, is utterly irrelevant to reality. All of it. The good, the bad, all of it. So in most spiritual teachings and in most spiritual venues, we are told, okay, here's the deal. Now I've got the real deal for you. You can forget about all the things you've been doing in the past. In fact, don't do them anymore. Do not do any more practices, whether they're worldly practices or spiritual practices. Do only this practice and you will be well. At the end of doing this practice, you will be fixed. You will finally get what you came for. But you have to do away with all those other things. You can't keep seeking after relationship in the world. You can't keep seeking after pleasure. You can't keep trying to get rid of pain or unpleasantness. You have to be finished with that before you can be free. And I've got the secret for you. Turn away from all that. Hew to this practice instead. Well, that's just foolishness. I mean, if we're being told the truth in the first place, maybe we're not. Maybe the Buddha and Shankara and Ramana and all of them are lying. But if they're not lying, then that whole craziness is false. Doesn't make any sense. None. If it's true that the only source of this dream of misery and bondage as a human being is a false belief about what I am, then no amount of practice or lack of practice can do anything about that other than perhaps exchange some old belief for some new belief. That don't work. We'll try that. It's mostly what we do. Let's try that. If it's true that the only problem is the false belief about what I am, then it must be true, clearly, intuitively true, that the only solution is to know the truth of what I am. All the rest of it is of no consequence. All the rest of it is the story about me. The only solution, the only being finished with the dream of suffering, is to know the truth of what I am. And then, even the dream of suffering is of no consequence. None. Even the dream of separation and contraction and aloneness is of no consequence. Here and now, in this moment, what am I? That's all that matters. And the remarkable thing about this is that well, first of all, what this is what Ramana calls self-inquiry. Self-inquiry is often received by us as being a new practice, something new to do, instead of all the old practices, whether the practices are spiritual or worldly. Self-inquiry is received as a new practice to replace all the old practices. So if I am not constantly looking to see what I am, if I am not permanently, consistently looking inward like a, well, I don't know, like a what? Like somebody sitting on a loincloth on a tiger skin somewhere, then I am failing in this practice. That too is nonsense. Really, it's nonsense. Here's the real deal. It doesn't matter, not in the slightest, what you do in your life. It is absolutely permissible and absolutely okay for you to continue just as you're doing, for you to seek pleasure, for you to try to avoid pain, for you to follow spiritual teachings, for you to do meditation, for you to do pranayama and kundalini practices. All that's perfectly okay. They can't hurt you, which of course is the clear implication of the announcement of these great beings anyway. Nothing can hurt you. So all that's fine. You can go looking for love in all the wrong places. You can do anything you want. Can't hurt you. Can have no effect whatsoever on your nature. None. You can continue practicing pranayama. You can go and pay $20,000 and go to India and take a 21-day enlightenment seminar or course or whatever they're doing over there. It's okay. Can't hurt you. Can't have any effect on you one way or the other. Some of your practices will produce pleasure. Some of your practices will produce pain. That's always been the case. It always will be the case. All that's required to be finished with the idea that any of that has anything to do with you is to just do this. Whenever you think of it, whenever it's possible for you to do so, just stop for 1 second, just for one moment, and see what you are, really. How hard can that be? You are here. No matter what else is happening, no matter what other magnificent spiritual explosions are taking place, no matter what other horrendous, contracted, selfish emotions are taking place, you are here. No matter what else is going on, you are here. You are never absent, never. You have never been absent, ever. You are absolutely untouched by any of it, ever. The difficulty of this offering, which comes from Ramana, the difficulty of it is that it's so easy. It requires nothing of you. I mean, it's okay if you don't do it, too. Do it or don't do it, you remain the same. See what you are or don't see what you are the same. Never absent, ever. Never changing, ever. Untouched, always. Now here's my experience if you do. If it does capture you, this possibility of seeing, of really seeing what I am, as if you ever saw anything else, of really tasting what it is to be me. Whenever you can, whenever it's possible, whenever it occurs to you, you just stop for a second and see what is the present experience feel like that makes it absolutely impossible for you to deny that you are. Just that. What is it to be here as you? Not the story about it. And stories about it will certainly arise. Pay them no mind. Just the actuality of it. I am here. What is that? And my experience with this is that, well, you know, when Ramana speaks about self-realization, of course now they're religifying Ramana. We do that. We make religious things. It's our reaction to truth. Can't help ourselves. But Ramana was much simpler than that. Ramana wasn't all into that religious stuff. For Ramana, realization was much simpler than that. You know, last weekend, I don't know what day it was, but I woke up and I knew, I think it was Friday. I woke up and I knew it was Sunday. I mean, I just woke up and it was Sunday. And everything that I did for hours in the morning was predicated on the idea that it was Sunday. And it's my habit, I get up in the morning and I let my cat out the front door for a while. And when it's time for the cat, and I leave the door ajar because we don't have a cat door. And when he's done outside, he pushes the door open and comes in and complains to me and tells me that the door is open, so I'll go close it for him. And generally then I'll go out and get the newspaper, which is on the driveway. And I went out this Friday, and there was a newspaper there, but on Sunday morning I get the New York Times delivered to the driveway. And the New York Times wasn't there. And I have had some experience in the past with not getting the New York Times on Sunday morning, and you have to go to their website and you fill out a little form and you tell them you didn't get their paper, and then the next day they deliver the paper to you, the Sunday paper to you. So I thought, okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to go through that again, and I don't get to read the editorials and stuff and see how terrible Bush is this morning. And I went on like that for a while, and I knew it was Sunday. And then an hour or so later, I looked at the paper that I had brought in, which was the LA Times, for Friday. And I looked at it, and I realized that it was Friday. That's the kind of realization that self-realization is. It's not the gates of heaven breaking open. It's the very simple, ordinary discovery that what has always been obvious is, I am here. This is what I am. Oh, right. That's the realization of Ramana Maharshi. The expectation that self-realization is some kind of a thunderous, magical, explosive thunderbolt, lightning bolt that transforms and transcends everything is A, foolish, and B, obviously not what people had in mind when they told us that we already are everything we have ever wanted. That there is nothing whatsoever that we have to do because we are, just as we are, in this moment, fully realized, fully awake, freedom itself. The realization of what you are is just as simple as the realization that it's Friday and not Sunday. Ah. Now, the other part of it is that the momentum of all of the, you know, the whole story about me, the whole story of me as the guy that was born in 1942 in New Jersey and had this drama and that drama and some other drama and this success and that failure and is now sitting here thinking he's a spiritual teacher, talking to people, having absolutely nothing to say that's of any value. That story, right? And the story of John Sherman is much better than that. I mean, it's really quite dramatic. That story has momentum. It is itself the karmic unfolding of this life. just as it is. It is entirely the outcome of cause and effect in the dream. There is nothing to it whatsoever that is intentional or willful. It is just the blind playing out of the consequences of past action. Mine, yours, whoever else's. So the expectation that realization A is some lightning stroke that changes everything, and B that everything is changed thereby, by everything meaning the story of me, is just foolishness. It is just buying into one more trip that guarantees that I will continue to suffer and try to get what I already am somewhere else. But the realization is simple, and it's available permanently here and now, in this moment. And the repetition of the turning away from what I have believed myself to be to the self-evident reality that I am causes this realization over time to saturate the story itself. And over time, the story itself kind of sweetens, becomes easy, like falling out of bed. The story itself is in no way different from me. It's in no way separate from me. It is, after all, a dream that appears within me and is made up only of me. There's nothing I can find anywhere that is not me. So the repetition of the simple turning of attention just for a second to what it feels like to be here now does change things, but not as you would expect it to. It changes things over time in ways that are unnoticeable until they're noticed. It changes things like the frog put in a pan of cold water and brought to a boil cooks without ever knowing that it's happening. It changes the story. It permeates the story. It saturates the story. The certain knowing of the truth of what you are is always present. Already always present. The willingness, not in place of some other practice, because it doesn't take. It takes just that. The willingness to just take that, whenever it occurs to you, to just feel what it's like to be you. Just that. Changes everything. While changing nothing. Saturates all. Without moving. This knowing is what you are. So that's what I come for. That's what I talk to people about. I don't have much to say about pranayama or kundalini or chakra practice or any of the great spiritual experiences. What I have to speak about and what I have to offer and what I have to say to you is that you are what you seek. And that with Ramana, the only thing standing between you and self-realization is the belief that you are not already fully realized. just as you are. And the suggestion that when such an incomprehensible claim is made, the only sane response to it is to look and see, what in the world could he be talking about? What am I? Really? And that's enough. Okay. If anybody wants to talk about it, just come up and talk. Okay? What's your name?
My name's Kaylee.
Kayla?
Kaylee.
Kaylin.
Kaylee.
Kaylin.
Yes,
Kaylee. Get it.
Yeah, I sat with you about 3 years ago in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, wow.
And here we are again.
Here we are again.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to know if you could speak. There's two things that are right here in front of me right now. And one of them is if you could speak about cellular memory in the body, around trauma, around the story, around things that have happened. Speaking specifically here with me, that's been very challenging for me and causing health problems and all kinds of things.
What are you doing about it?
And, pardon?
What are you doing about it?
Therapy and also just my own meditation practice and letting this part of my body speak to me mm-hmm. about what it's feeling, letting mm-hmm. it have a voice so that it's not squelched.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with that. There are many therapeutic practices and therapies that are specifically designed to deal with such issues and such problems.
Right.
And they can be quite effective and quite useful. This is part of what I'm talking about when I say you need to abandon none of your practices.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Partly it's because some of these practices can be quite useful mm-hmm. to the body, to the story, to the personality. The problem arises when we take these practices to be the solution. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like if I have a headache, I take an aspirin. I don't expect the aspirin to reveal to me that I am freedom itself. I expect the aspirin to fix the headache,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
It's the same with practices, whether they are meditation practices or other therapy practices that are designed to do something about what you're talking about, trauma trapped in the body and so forth. If that's what you see them, their usefulness to be, they can be of no trouble to you.
Mm-hmm.
If, on the other hand, you think that they'll give you freedom, then you're mistaken. Nothing can give you freedom. Nothing. You are free. And the consistency with which this business of freedom is spoken about in spiritual circles is quite surprising given the lack of freedom that's offered by most spiritual teachings, which is not the case with Ramana.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not the case with me. So I don't know anything about these practices, and I have very little to offer in the way of things that can be healing or useful to the body. You know, these are karmic unfoldments, as is everything else. But I know that they can be helpful. But nothing whatsoever, not pain and misery in the body, not the release from pain and misery in the body, touches you. Can you see that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're here.
Yeah.
You're reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It becomes it's more like it's a tool, but it's not.
Yes, that's right.
It.
And once you see that, yeah, right, then you can be discerning and discriminating about,
sure,
well, is this working or isn't it working?
That's right. Yeah.
Once you see what you really can get from it,
mm-hmm,
then it can be much more useful to you than during the period of time when we think, oh, well, this is what stands in the way of me being free.
Mm-hmm.
So what has to happen in order for me to be free is to get rid of this turmoil in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Once that idea is revealed to be false, then these practices can be much more effective, much more useful,
mm-hmm,
to you.
Right. Yeah, more powerful. Okay, thank you. The other thing, if I may, to speak about is something that I have such a hard time with, and it is the cruelty to animals. I'm speaking specifically of the seal slaughter that's starting.
Hello?
The seals in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Got an email from the Humane Society this morning, and I just can't get the thoughts out of my head. It's and yet I know that's not helping the situation. It's only causing suffering for me. And I wanted...
Why do you say that it's causing suffering? These thoughts are causing suffering for you.
Oh, it makes me incredibly sad that there's the
cruelty going on. What is it about sadness that's a problem?
Well, it's not. I guess it's not a problem.
Right.
So just allow myself to feel.
You can't... Have you found anything that'll prevent you from feeling that?
No, I haven't.
Then why bother yourself with it? These feelings, the horror, the kind of hatred that comes from seeing what the cruelty that people are capable of.
Mm-hmm.
These feelings come on their own. You don't bring them. You don't decide to feel these things. And similarly, they depart on their own. Mm-hmm. Nothing you can do gets rid of them.
Right.
In fact, anything
yeah.
you try to do to get rid of them probably makes the body worse.
Right.
You know, it's like a self-hatred, a self-denial.
Yeah, it's the resistance of trying.
So see, you know, when I asked you, why is sadness a problem? Then you say, well, maybe it's not a problem. Sadness comes. Sadness goes. Self-hatred comes. Self-hatred goes.
Yeah.
The condemnation of the evildoers comes. The condemnation of the evildoers goes. You remain. None of that is of any consequence to you. There's no need for you to do anything about that. That's the point. The idea that these things have to go, these bad feelings, the killing of the seals in Canada, my reaction to them, my powerlessness to do anything about it, the sadness and frustration and uselessness that I feel as a result of this, the idea that these things have to go in order for me to be okay is just a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to see that is in the midst of it, here and now, look and see, what are you really? Not what are you in order to deny these other things, but just in order to know, in the midst of it all, what am I, really? What's it feel like to be here, really, underneath all of it? And that's the sword that cuts through it all.
Right.
That seeks to do away with nothing, seeks to change nothing,
mm-hmm.
seeks not even to change the impulse to change things.
Mm-hmm. Right. Just being with all of it.
You are anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
So suggesting is not to... See, that's the kind of thing that we do in spiritual circles. We try to take on some new belief, right? Like, be okay with all of it. Okay, well, now I'm going to try to be okay with all of it. But you already are. I mean, you are the space in which it all lives and mm-hmm. moves.
Right.
Comes and goes. So the movement from the imagined idea of moving from wanting to get rid of this to welcoming it or allowing it to be here is just another story, another practice, which you're welcome to try. But even in the midst of that practice, here you are, mm-hmm. never absent, never changing. Mm-hmm. Here you are. And it's the willingness to see that that eradicates the false belief that drives the idea that I am at the mercy of this unfolding story of Kaylin and her concerns and her problems and her goodness and her badness and so forth. It doesn't do away with the story of Kaylin. It doesn't do away with her concerns and her problems and her goodness and her badness, mm-hmm. but it does away with the belief that I am that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Which is the only real problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So whenever you can, just stop for a second. What am I, really? What's it feel like, really, to be? And let the rest of it be as it is.
Right. Okay.
Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Are you living here now?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Yes. Do I know your name?
Rob.
Rob.
Yeah.
Did you write to me?
I did write to you, oh, yes.
Beautiful email.
Well, I just I can't thank you enough.
I can't say you're welcome enough.
And although I did share with you in the email, I wanted to share with you again here. You're the clearest, most direct person I've ever met in person, in through a book, anything. Nobody has touched me as directly with the only thing that matters, my own being, who I am, than you have. And how you've brought Ramana Maharshi, who used to exist way up here, down into my heart, to a place where I can truly recognize his being and my own being as being, and that he was communicating that to me. He's communicating the same thing my heart communicates to me. Nobody's communicated that until I met you. I mean, nobody stripped it down so I could really hear it from my own heart, trust my own heart, that my own heart, your heart, Ramana's heart is saying the same thing. And I thank you for that.
Well, you're very welcome. You're very welcome.
And I did have one question. I wrote you a second email.
I guess I haven't seen it.
Maybe not, but it deals with, you've clarified a lot of it today, but I wanted to share it with you and see if you could clarify. So, dearest John, meeting Ramana through your grace has been such a blessing. I know in my heart that Ramana is my very own self and that his simple words point to the ever-present truth of being. The way in which you share Ramana with all of us is the way I have always known him in my own heart. There is peace and the end of all inner war. However, reading Ramana's words seem to have a different effect on me. They seem foreign at times. They seem to point to states and a need to continually abide in a state with no thought in order to be realized. The words seem to instantly place miles between us, he being in and describing an unknown rapturous state of realization, and me reading about it but not experiencing that state.
Aha. Can I interrupt you for one second here? Who says you're not experiencing that state? What's your basis for saying that? You see, Ramana was limited, just as any human being is limited. Ramana had only the tools, the words, the concepts, the ideas that were present in his culture as he grew up and matured, with which to express what he found. But I say that although Ramana, because of his limitation, was given to expressing himself with the traditional ways of seeing these things, of expressing these things, that the bliss and the rapture that he reports is exactly the same as you. Exactly the same. The only difference is your ideas of what he's saying and speaking about. But when you see that in the end, at the end of the day, Ramana always comes back to the simplest, most direct instruction, which is, who are you, really? Or is, be as you are. I mean, hear that. Be as you are. We hear that and we have a spiritual context that we place it in. And it's like it's some big thing. Be as you are. Be as you are. It's no big deal. It's you, just as you are. And that's what Ramana always comes back to. Be as you are. So I hear Ramana say that, the things that he says, and it's really clear to me that what he speaks of is exactly what I know, exactly what you know, exactly. It's not the same as your thoughts about what he's saying. It's never the same as your thoughts about what he's saying. But you check and see the reality of what it is to be, and then you will see how it comes to pass that these highfalutin spiritual expressions come to be used to describe what is ordinary, what is here, permanent, what is real, now. Then you'll see for yourself how that comes to pass and you'll laugh. Oh yeah, sure. He said a lot of things that would not be the way I would describe reality. But I don't even have the nerve to try to describe reality. I say, you see, you look, you see what you are. That's real. That's exactly what Ramana spoke of. That's the natural state that Ramana... When Ramana speaks of states, the only state that's of any value to him is Sahaja Samadhi, the natural state. That's you, just as you are, here and now. So, go on.
Yes, I said, why is this? When I know myself to be this never-changing, ever-present beingness holding whatever state happens to arise within me, why does it seem like these words in these Ramana books demand to experience a certain state when self is what allows states to seemingly exist in the first place? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Have you ever experienced this sort of relationship with the words of Ramana? Because I can only assume you have read quite a bit of his words, and when you speak of him, when you share the gift he has given you, it is so crystal clear, so straightforward and simple, and exactly, nearly, word for word, the same experience and words I myself use and are alive in my very own heart. But all of these Ramana books, I don't get it. Any insight you could share? Thank you.
I agree with you. You know, something about Ramana and my relationship with Ramana that needs to be put into light here is that I had no interest in Ramana. I met Gangaji in prison in 1994, and there immediately was broken open with such an array of spiritual experience that it damn near did me in. Right? Well, what I call it spiritual experience, I had, you know, samadhis and bliss and oceanic consciousness and all that stuff. None of it did me a bit of good. None of it. I had the spiritual, deep spiritual longing and the burning, and none of it did me a bit of good. None of it. It perpetuated the belief that I was the story of John Sherman, which had now taken this turn where John Sherman had become, well, Buddha, I guess, right? Awake, enlightened, realized. Same story, just it had taken a different turn. And for that first year, I practiced a great desperation to keep these states coming, these states of bliss, these states of clarity, these states of hearing the stones sing, and so forth. Some of the stuff I wrote, you may never see, and I just assume you didn't, because they are the same kind of sutras that have confused us so much in the past. But the actual reality of what was going on was a very deep inward suspicion that this was fake. The states were as real as they could be, but a deep inward suspicion that this was fake, and that although I didn't have the discernment and discrimination to understand what I saw, that since they had come, they would go. And when they went, I would be bereft. So the first year was spent desperately engaging in the same old practices that I had engaged in with such uselessness for all of my life, trying to hold on to what I liked and deny what I didn't like. Only now, what I liked was, well, God, right? I mean, this was the real deal here. After a year, and this is just my story, it's not, and it in some ways parallels other stories of spiritual experiences and dark nights of the soul and all. I've read all of that. After a year, I couldn't do it anymore. And I entered the state that one would expect to follow upon the state of heavenly bliss, which is the state of hellish torment and loss and torture. And I had already long since dismissed Ramana on a number of grounds, one of the most important grounds being that, well, yeah, right, what am I? Right, I am infinite eternal consciousness. Duh. I don't need Ramana for that. I already know that. Yeah, I'm glad Ramana, you know, was with Papaji and all of that, but it's too simple for me. It's some Indian guru in a loincloth. And I know what I am. I am infinite, eternal, empty consciousness. I am Buddha mind. So on that ground, I dismissed Ramana. And the other ground on which I dismissed Ramana was the same ground that you're speaking of in this email. which is, well, yeah, but what little I've seen of him, you know, he's all into this stuff, this Indian spiritual samadhis and states. And, but in the self-inflicted belief that I had fallen into hell, into torment and loss and torture and hopelessness, in the midst of that, not knowing where else to turn, I finally turned to Ramana. And I, instead of thinking that I knew what Ramana was about, I started reading Ramana. And I, by the time I was done, probably read everything that has been translated into English pertaining to Ramana and with Ramana's discourses and conversations with people. And I discovered that all of that, I discovered A, that the idea that I am infinite, eternal, empty consciousness is false. Any idea about what I am is false. Another belief, one more false belief that I tried to put in place of the old false belief, but the new false belief is the same as the old false belief. It is the belief that I am the story of John Sherman. And secondly, I saw that Ramana stumbled upon reality when he was 16 years old, which was a great stroke of luck for us all. Because Ramana stumbled upon reality before he had had a lifetime of spiritual indoctrination, of the actual taking on of all of those teachings and all of those Upanishads and Vedas and sutras and so forth, before they became a huge part of his consciousness. So he didn't have that framework in which to fit the reality that he had stumbled upon. And we're all very fortunate for that. In the 12 years following that stumbling upon reality, Ramana read all that stuff. He spoke to no one. He read all that stuff. People were, you know, the Indian spiritual types are very sensitive to these things, and they would see him and kind of get hooked up with him and follow him around and chase him down and so forth. But Ramana for 12 years didn't speak to anybody because he didn't want to speak to anybody. That's later how he reported on why he didn't speak to anybody, because he didn't want to speak to anybody, really simply. No big spiritual brouhaha about it. And he read all of that stuff. And he learned all of those prior attempts to say what really cannot be said, not because it is so far apart from you, but because it is so close to you. Because it is you. Because it's so simple. Not because it's so big. Because it's so simple. So ordinary. So by the time he's teaching, right, he has now the vocabulary that comes from the all that spiritual development in India over all those centuries and millennia. And that's the only vocabulary he has to speak with, but he sees through it very clearly, as you will see if you spend a year with Ramana reading everything he has to say. Those expressions that he makes always come back to the same simple reality. What are you? For whom is this a problem? Who are you really? Ramana was erudite and was well versed in all of the practices that were around in India in those days, and encouraged people in their practice, and even was helpful sometimes, but always come back to the bare bones reality of it, which is that the only thing standing between you and the certainty of your nature is a false belief about your nature. So although all of those words he uses, I use a different kind of language. I use the language of America in the 20th and now the 21st century. I use the language of the streets because that's my background. I use the language of Christianity sometimes because that's my background. I use some of the language of the Indian teachings because I have learned something about them. But my language is as limited and as false as all the stuff about states that Ramana expressed. The only thing that's true about what I say, the only thing that needs to be listened to, is my admonition endlessly to you to find out what you are now, here, in this moment. Never then. Never. You have never, ever found the truth of what you are then. And you never will then. But you are here now. That's all that matters. Pay no mind to all the stories about what you are, no matter how beautiful they are, no matter how ugly they are. You are here. You are not far. It is not difficult for you to know directly, consciously, in this moment, the truth of your nature. It is endlessly, absolutely present, this reality that you are. It's not difficult. It takes no practice. It takes no understanding. It takes no comprehension of spiritual understanding, nor does it take any rejection of the comprehension of spiritual understanding. You are here. All that, all of that is just story. All of it. The only thing that is not story is you. Here, now. And all the stories are about you. All the stories of God consciousness, of Krishna, of enlightenment, of the stages of samadhi, all of those things are about you. All the stories about warfare and internal warfare and external warfare, about love and compassion, about romance and loss and gain. They're all about you, all of them, and none of them. None, nothing can ever be said that says what you are. But you know what you are. You are here. You are never absent. Just look to that whenever you can. And that's the real teaching of Ramana. And if I have a teaching, that's the real teaching of John Sherman. And it has nothing to do with any of the other pretty or not so pretty words that I put on it. It has nothing to do with any states that come and go. You're here. What is that? What's that feel like? Is that helpful?
Yeah, very helpful. Thank you.
It's so ingrained in us to listen to what's being said as if the words meant anything. You know, it's like the words that Ramana uses as if they meant anything. Hmm. They don't mean anything. As if the words of all of the teachers, as if the words meant anything. We say these words in order to trick you into looking at yourself. Just that. Just to trick you into looking at yourself. If Ramana says this, and this is on, there's a book of Ramana's discourses, which has a foreword by Carl Jung. And the picture of Ramana, underneath the picture of Ramana is the quote from Ramana that I use often and have used today. The only thing standing between you and self-realization is the belief that you are not already fully realized, just as you are. Now, that's a trick. I mean, if Ramana is this saint, right, this God creature, and he says something like that to you, wouldn't you wonder, what in the world is he talking about? What am I? What is it I believe myself to be? What am I that is fully realized? What's he talking about? And all the highfalutin clouds and bursts and breaking open and heart stuff, all of that is just to trick you into that. Because it doesn't take you understanding it. It just takes you seeing directly, consciously, in this moment, what you are. And the realization of that is as simple as realizing it's Friday and not Sunday. No big deal. No drama. And it's a realization that must be repeated. Every time you wake up and think it's Sunday when it's Friday, well, you just got to find out it's Friday again. Yes. You see? Okay. Anything else?
No, just, you know.
I'm really happy to see you, Rob.
Yeah, I can't say enough, and I thank you. And it's just a blessing how simple and clear you meet all of us.
Oh, you're really welcome. That's what I live for. My whole life is to trick you. You know, somebody just comes up and says, hey, check this out. What's it feel like to be you? Probably nothing much would come of that. But if somebody comes up and goes to this big rigmarole, right, and starts talking in spiritual jargon and draws you in, and then says to you, hey, right now, just in this moment, can you see what it feels like to be here? Then you might say, oh, wait a minute. What else? Anything else? It really is just this simple, my friends, just this simple. No matter what you think, no matter what thoughts you are in love with or hate, no matter what seems to be going on, you are here. You. No matter all of the stuff about ego and killing ego and the problem of ego and all of that, egolessness and emptiness and fullness, no matter any of that, you are here. That's all that you know. All. There's nothing else that's known. Other than that you are here. Therefore, see that. See that. See the here-ness of you. The presence of you. Prior to calling it presence. Prior to calling it here. See consciously. Consciously see the reality of what you are. Consciously see this that has never changed, that is absolutely the same, this that in which the story of John Sherman has unfolded as a child, as a adolescent, as a soldier, as a machinist, as a criminal, as a communist revolutionary, as a convict, as a spiritual teacher, as an aging American male. But I have never changed. Never. I have never changed. I have never moved. Isn't that true for you? Isn't that as true for you? As it is for me, as it is for Ramana, as it is for the Buddha. You have never changed. See that. Okay. Thank you for your attention and your time. I'm very happy to be in satsang with you.